Welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces. We're going to be joined next half hour by Dr. Cliff Perry. He is the Auburn University Hudson Professor Chair Emeritus of Political Science and one of two presenters this month for, or actually next month, for the Academy for Learning in Retirement. There will be two presentations on the visual and verbal weapons in World War II. On Wednesday, December 3rd, Mary Cronin will be giving a discussion on the photography of Albert T. Palmer, who brought a visual weapon to America's arsenal in World War II. Bruce Bierman, NMSU Associate Professor in Journalism and Mass Communication, will also be involved in that discussion as well. And then on Thursday, December 4th, Cliff Perry, who we'll be talking to next, will give a presentation on how a unique group of Marines, Navajos, enlisted men, became essential to success in the Pacific through the use of their native language. That really wasn't as difficult as I made it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And it is a fascinating topic. We were talking a little bit about, before you came on air, about the fact that because of movies and kind of popular culture, a lot of people are aware of the Navajo cult. Code talkers, but maybe just kind of on a surface level. So can you talk a little bit about your presentation and what you're going to be getting into?
Well, as a lawyer might say, I thought I would bring lay a foundation, which would make more salient the importance of the language for the Navajos. I mean, something that someone might have stumbled upon at one point, versus a gift given to them by virtue of, you know, an intentional act. So serendipity gave me this gift, and now I have this, versus I have a gift from someone, right, that one is more purposeful, one it's more meaningful, perhaps, than the other, even though they may be exactly the same gift. And so the Navajos, if I can, the Dene.
Dene, right. Yes.
But they're not, you know, they don't have an issue with use of Navajo for reference to them at all. Whereas you can imagine Sioux do, right. And the Iroquois do.
Yeah. But I think especially historically, when you're talking about the 1940s, they were Navajo.
Right. So. And also there's, you know, contravailing forces that would gainsay the Navajos actually helping the United States. They're as generally tribes might be reluctant to help, although they always do. And then insult to the Navajos themselves, which they seem to have completely granted remission for those sins that were committed against
them. It's an interesting insight. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. They always do.
Yeah, I mean, they always do.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, think it's not the Navajos, but think of the Japanese internment camps, 122,000 people, and then 33,000 joined the army.
Right.
Right. And then I think it's the 100th, but, you know, the 100th unit, they did it through two, 442nd and the 100th. The 100th was the most militarily decorated battalion in World War II, in military history, actually, not just the war. It's amazing.
It's amazing when you think of being able to transcend what the government has done to your community, and then to see in a broader picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very astute.
So whose idea was this to take their native language and use that as something that would
an unbreakable
work as a
code.
Military
yeah.
code?
Yeah. Yes. It ends up being completely unbreakable. His name was Philip Johnson, and he was a four-year-old, which is for non-Navajos, Belaganas, the only way to learn Navajo. His parents were Protestant missionaries, and they were assigned, I think, billeted, so to speak, the Navajo Nation. So they took their
they went there and stayed 19 years, at least he stayed there 19 years, playing with Navajo children, going to school with the Navajos, and he became literally bilingual.
Yeah.
And he's listening to, what is the problem? This is not the Enigma machine, how major plans are being done. It is battlefield communication.
Which is so critical, and yet you cannot afford anybody to hear those.
No, you can't. And then, you know, when they used the white code, little cylinders, I mean, it's something played with when we were children. And that code is, that could be accurate, right? It had, but it was painfully slow, painfully slow. So how do you expedite that?
Yeah.
He hears this problem about how the Marines, I know this sounds sort of strange, the Marines, when high-pressed, didn't have time to do this.
Of course not. And yeah, so, like a Rubik's Cube kind of thing.
Yes, right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have time, so what they would end up doing is breaking into English.
Oh. Yeah.
Right, in the, you know, yeah, the Japanese spoke English. And
right.
So
right.
The Japanese troops did. And the only thing to do, they thought, was to lace the English, this sounds naive, lace the English with profanity. And the more profane, the better, right? So they would lace it with this whole naive idea, excuse me, that the Navajos, I mean, that the Japanese had no idea about profanity.
Oh, gosh.
Right? But of course they did.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the first thing you learn when you learn another person's
in
language.
In fact, most people learn language, you know, pick up a language because they, first of all, learned how to curse in it.
That's right? Yeah, that's what
I don't say most, but a lot of people do.
So what position was he in at the time that he was able to make this recommendation?
He was 50 years old, and he was just listening to, I know this sounds weird as well, listening to a Los Angeles radio station, and they were talking about the problem of accurate, secure,
so he wasn't in the military at that time.
No, he was too old for World War II.
Wow.
So
he just called somebody up and said, hey, I got an idea.
Yeah, he actually, he went to Fort Elliott in it was Los Angeles, and so he went down to San Diego, and in San Diego he talked to a lieutenant colonel, and the lieutenant colonel said, well, how does this, you know, what does it sound like? And he spoke a sentence, and the lieutenant colonel said, let's try it. That was that quick.
Wow.
So then they brought in and tested it against the white.
Is there something about their language that makes it so difficult to decipher?
It's, for starters, it's tonal.
Okay.
So whereas English is not tonal at all.
Right.
Navajo language is very tonal, which means that I guess if you use a verb or any other word, you're going to change the meaning of it by the tone at which it's spoken. So, you know, a high-pitched or, I mean, it's not like the kind of tone you heard when you might have been a child and your parent might have said, don't take that tone with me.
Right.
Right? They don't mean that at all. They're just, that kind of tone is one in which I belie my feelings, my intentions, my motives, or am I being sarcastic? But I don't change the meaning of the word.
Right.
Right? But in Navajo, you would. So, I mean, that's one. It's also very verb-heavy, full of prefixes and suffixes. And then on top of that, it's not memorialized. It's not a written language at all.
Oh, so there's no way someone could pick up a dictionary on
that's
the
right,
other side
that's right, and find out what the hell is going on here.
Okay.
Sorry. And so that there's a, you know, that distinction between, I don't think many native languages were memorialized, and I don't know one except for Sequoias with the Cherokees, and that was because he was told that they would never be accepted unless they were civilized, and they would only be civilized if their people were literate.
Mm.
And so they became literate, but their alphabet, I mean, their units for the language were syllables, so it was a syllabic sort of alphabet, whereas opposed to letters. The Navajo is letters.
right? And it started, I guess, in the mid 20th century, too, sort of. But they have to have 36 letters, whereas I think we still have only 26.
Yeah.
Right. Is that right? We haven't added any since.
Right.
Right. So there, I mean, even putting it in a sort of English form, a Latin script form, it still is completely different from reading. And in fact, that's a plague for elderly people on the reservation. They speak Navajo fluently, but they can't read Navajo because they can't read English.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Were they teaching it to Anglo soldiers, or were they pretty much relying on Navajos to?
They relied on Navajos. No, Navajo Marines, the initial 29, and they ended up getting 450.
Okay.
420 of whom actually saw duty in the Pacific.
This is really fascinating, too, because Asian languages have different tonal traditions, too. So that in itself probably wouldn't have been enough to stymie a hacker, a Japanese hacker. But the fact that it wasn't written, the fact that it was, there are all those other points that you made that together made it incomprehensible.
Yeah.
And I would love to have seen the face of the guys trying to hack it, going, what the heck is this?
Well, that was many of their responses. We thought that after the war, the Japanese said, we'd listen to these, this.
So they're intercepting the communication.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And they couldn't hear it.
They'd pick up and they said, we just thought people were drunk. And word was, we thought they were inebriated. What is this nonsense? In fact, in Guadalcanal, they failed to tell the Marines that were already there that these Navajo co-talkers were arriving, and they Navajo co-talkers flooded the American frequencies, and all the Marines there said, we've been taken over. What happened? What's going on? It was just they couldn't understand it. Obviously, they thought it was quote unquote gibberish.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
A brilliant gibberish. Yes.
That's right, exactly.
Life-saving.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how did you become interested in this field of study? You're a political scientist. So
I'm a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
But also, my PhD is in philosophy.
Okay.
That might tell you something. Being reared when when every other show on television was a Western.
Yeah.
You know, I came to have a very romantic idea of the Native tribes, Native mm-hmm. nations. And when I took the New Mexico bar I had taken the Alabama bar, but then I thought, I don't want to settle here. I want to settle in New Mexico. And so I took the New Mexico bar, and I heard people talking about taking the Navajo bar. And, I thought, oh, good God, I've got to do that.
Wow.
And so I found out about it. And the next year, I took the Navajo bar. And so that allows you to practice on the reservation. You can't do anything else on the reservation, of course. You could live there, but you cannot run for office or anything
that.
Yeah. But I could help people.
Yeah.
And so I took the Navajo bar and somehow passed
it. Did you learn Diné?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I can say a few words like
yes.
Yaate and, Diné and,
But their trials are in English?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because most of for Belaganas taking the exam, first of all, you have to belong to the bar of one of the four states, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, or New Mexico. And then if you pass the exam, if you're a Navajo member, then you can start practicing right away. But if you are, but they don't have to have a state certification, bar passing. But the non-Navajo has to then go to a culture course. And so much of what I can talk about, I sort of learned, especially the importance of the language.
Yeah.
Right.
I was going to say that was a naive question. Of course, the trial's in English. I guess the more important question is, what is the status of the language? Are children still learning their mm-hmm. native language?
Yeah, it is the most widely spoken native language there is. I mean, okay. that is in the United States.
Yeah, I know that there has been a real effort to preserve
exactly.
it.
Yeah. But and there has to be an effort because of the boarding schools. Cut your hair and stop speaking.
Exactly.
Yes, you're punished.
Yeah, they did everything. We did everything we could.
Thank God they failed.
Beat it out. Yeah, that's right. Right.
Yes, it's very important.
Well, and we're a little bit off topic, but I said something in the first half hour that doesn't make any sense to anybody who's listening. I said Thanksgiving is my most conflicted holiday, and I never explained why. I said I love the fact that we have a holiday that we explain that's about gratitude and where we express our gratefulness. I never said why I was conflicted, though. The conflicted part for me is just the origin story is such a great big lie.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and that we learn as children and that many people believe till they die. And so that's why I'm conflicted about it, is I just wish we were more honest about how all of that went down.
That's right. I understand that completely. The conflict of, or the, you know, the disabusing of your childhood fantasies.
Yes.
From 1951 to 1960, I think they had a show, syndicated show on television called The Adventures of Kit Carson. And then I went, when I was being sworn in, the Supreme Court Justice of New Mexico denigrated Kit Carson. And I thought, why? Why would you be upset with Kit Carson? And then, of course, that's one of the reasons why the long walk for the Navajos is chiefly at the hands of Kit Carson and his superiors.
Yeah.
To punish them for their impertinence, for not wanting Belaganas, all these people rushing across because of the gold rush, right?
Right.
Then the building of Fort Defiance, and that was all because of, you know, that Kit Carson and his
childhood hero
scorched the earth policy.
Yes. Which makes it all the more amazing that they are, as you said at the very beginning, the first to sign up and want to serve this country.
Yeah, you'd think that they would be very reluctant, at least. And by the way, you know, it's sort of strange. Most people, all you had to do was read the 14th Amendment, you'd think, golly, you're born in America.
Yep.
You're an American citizen. Native Americans didn't become American citizens until 1924. And yet, in World War I, which I think was, for the Americans, 1918, they drafted American Indians.
Yeah, right.
Right. I mean, they drafted non-citizens.
Yeah, wow. To fight for the forcibly.
There would have been a legal case for you to take, wouldn't it?
Yeah. That's sort of very, very, very odd. Very.
How long were the code talkers? Did that just at the end of World War II, was that the end of it, or did it last longer?
No, that's one of the reasons why it wasn't disclosed to the public, is that they had this perfect code.
Yes.
And they thought, we're not going to make it public, so don't go home and tell your families what you're doing, what you did. Don't tell them. I mean, you can go home and say you were in the service, but don't tell them what you did. And then it was used in Korea. And allegedly a little bit in Vietnam, but mostly Korea. And some of the original code talkers came back and did it in Korea as well.
Yeah.
And those guys, I think, were all honored for their services, weren't they?
Yeah. By 1982, that's when
Took a while.
71, President Nixon wanted to compliment them on their patriotism. And it's odd. If you have a word, I take it the word is supposed to distinguish something from its contradiction, right? Up is distinguished from not up, I guess, down. Well, Navajos have no word for patriotism.
Interesting.
They didn't have a word for it.
Yeah.
So I take it that was a matter of course. Of course you would do these things, okay, as opposed to, golly, you were really patriotic to do that.
It was a given.
It was. It's the only reason, only thing I can think of, that they had no non-patriotic acts. There were no such things.
Yeah.
And that, again, the importance of structuring your world around your language, right?
Yes, and of course, then that explains why they were among the first to sign up, because it's a given that you serve a community.
Yes.
As we said, there's been so much talked about them in popular culture and movies, television, that kind of thing. Is there anything that they've gotten wrong? Because there always is whenever you do a movie about something.
Well, I guess the chief one is that the Belagana officer or enlisted personnel that accompanied the Navajo was there to kill the Navajo code talker should he be captured.
I see.
Right. So if you were about to get captured, you were. And that was the Wind Talker's presentation, was that it sounded in the very, piecemeal through the movie, was that that was the purpose of having, but it actually was to save the save the code talker, because the code talker had an 80-pound radio to carry around,
right,
and also the many other Marines looked at Navajos and thought, you're Asian.
Yes.
Yeah. Not. And so it saved their lives from friendly fire.
Right.
That was their main purpose. And I don't know anything about, I hadn't really heard until I saw that movie, that they were there also to stop the Navajos from being captured and then, tortured to give up the code.
Yeah, right, of course.
Which, of course, would have been, if it's hard for adults to learn Navajo, virtually impossible. I don't know what benefit that might have had. The Japanese are looking at this, unless they have a much better, a better grasp of native languages than we do.
Does sound like the kind of embellishment that would make in a movie to try to, take a point and just emphasize it. Yeah.
But I'd never read anything.
Right. What haven't we asked you about? I mean, it's such a wide topic.
How tall I am.
Okay. How tall are you?
The slow opening of the acknowledgement of the code talkers and how long that took. I mean, 1945 it ends, but it's not allowed to be talked about, up through Vietnam until 1968, when it was declassified.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then celebrated in 1971, and then really in 1982.
Right.
DeConcini, Arizona.
Yeah. And by the time that happened, how many of them were still alive?
Very few, actually.
Yeah.
Very few. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there may be one. Mr. Nez is he won the Congressional Gold Medal in 2001, but I don't know for certain if he is still alive.
Right.
But I thought he was the last one.
Is there any kind of museum or any kind of permanent celebration of what they did?
No, I fear I do not know.
Yeah.
I know that there are places in Window Rock that have something. There is a place in Window Rock that has something to do with demonstrating the code talkers' heroic actions, but I don't, like radios and things like that and pictures, but I don't know of anything else.
So the Dene language was flexible enough to come up with battlefield terms that then could communicate. Did the language, Dene language, change at all in that period?
God, what a great question. Because the Navajo language, if they don't have, certain words, and they didn't for,
missiles.
Submarine, right, things like that. What a battleship. What the
hell?
So there are 274 words that were, were categorized. So, commanding officer becomes war chief. Okay. You know, yes. And platoons become, you know, mud clans, and there are 274. But even after that, they had to resort to spelling, which slowed things down. Yeah. So they really were reluctant to do this. But they would take, and so in Pacific, you know, I would have, for every letter, I would have a animal. Mm-hmm. Or I would have a place in Window Rock or Ship Rock, which would allow for my, just take the first letters and, you know, you'd say the, you know, your ant, you know, ice, fox.
Wow, that would be slow.
That would be.
I know that you can never exactly quantify things like this, but how pivotal was that? How many lives potentially were saved, do you think, because of that 50-year-old guy's, you know, brilliant idea and the willingness of all of those men to serve?
Yeah. As far as I could tell, the one general had said that indeed, as many, he was talking about Iwo Jima. Mm, I mean, we're talking about, you know, 68,000 Americans, you know, and 200,000 something like killed, or not killed, but wounded. He said that is because of the Navajo language, as many men were saved at Iwo Jima, more were saved than were killed in bringing about the capture of Iwo Jima.
So tens of thousands.
Well, yeah, for the wounded, 200,000, but also 68,000 Americans died, and you know, almost every defender was killed.
Right, right.
Which is almost every defender. Wow.
Yeah. That's an amazing thing.
Such a powerful story. Yeah. So this is a. It's been delightful
What? Either one of you, did I say anything that actually you hadn't known before?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, yes.
I loved your explanation about mud clans and how do you describe a submarine? Because I would wonder about that. There's not a whole lot up in Ship Rock that looks anything like the Pacific Islands.
I don't, because I think submarine is shark. And I thought, How the heck did you come up with? Are there no sharks in Window Rock or Ship Rock?
Well, that's true. That's true.
I mean, what? How did you pull that off? I didn't realize that.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah. I didn't know the Navajos, you know, how did they make that equation?
Well, and languages change and evolve according to circumstances. And this was a flexibility that the Navajo code talkers had that maybe we underestimate.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point as well, because, you know, it's the Navajo isolation that probably made them unintelligible to other Athabascan tribes.
Yes.
I mean, Apaches maybe heard certain words that they recognized, but for the most part, Navajos were sui generis.
Yeah.
We have been talking for the last half hour with Cliff Perry. Once again, he will be one of the presenters for the Academy for Learning in Retirement. His presentation will be on Thursday, December 4th. There will also be one on Wednesday, December 3rd. As always, those will be at Doniana County Community College. You can go to the Doniana Community College website and type in ALR to pre-register, or you can just simply show up at the event. And Dr. Perry, thanks so much for joining us. This has been fascinating.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.